WMFO, Medford.
Adventures in Research. How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Paul Shannon introducing another in the series of programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. And here to act as guide along these highways and byways of science is Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, whose lectures on these same adventures in research have taken him throughout the country.
Thank you, Paul, and hello, everyone.
Well, what are we going to talk about today, Dr. Thomas?
I have several subjects to discuss, Mr. Shannon. All of them interrelated and woven together into a story we'll call Eyes and Ears for the Millions.
Eyes and Ears for the Millions. That's a colorful title, all right. But what's it mean? And what are some of these subjects?
Oh, the telegraph, telephone, radio, television. All of them as timely as tomorrow. As absorbing a story as any thriller ever written.
I'll agree to that, Dr. Thomas. Radio alone is still an amazing miracle to me, after all the years I've been in it.
It is to a great many people, and the story of how radio and radio broadcasting came into being is an equally amazing one.
It shouldn't be much of a secret to you, Dr. Thomas. After all, your own particular field of science is electricity.
Yes, but just the same. New ideas and new applications of radio waves are constantly flowing from the laboratories and industrial plants. And it's important that we keep abreast of these improvements, you know.
Oh, sure. It's easy to fall behind and suddenly find yourself out of date.
Exactly. Since the dawn of civilization, man has ever tried to improve the art of communication. And history is filled with reports of inventions and discoveries along these lines.
You mean like the Indian smoke blanket signals and the tom-toms of the jungle tribes?
That's right, yes. And all the improvements that followed. Since radio is based on electricity, any discussion of it could go back many years, say to the discovery of the peculiar spark-producing properties of amber when this material was rubbed on a piece of cloth or fur, or to the magnetic attraction in lodestone, dating such knowledge as far back as 600 B.C.
That's a long way to go back, all right.
However, just now we're interested in the story of radio and how modern broadcasting grew from the simple experiments of amateurs, conducted both before and after World War I, to become the mammoth industry it is today.
That's a mighty big story, Dr. Thomas.
Yes, it is, and a fascinating and exciting one. The fact that modern radio has developed into a miraculous art which wields such a tremendous influence on our everyday lives is in itself a monument to all those unsung, uncrowned men whose tireless efforts and hard work made that development possible.
Not to mention those valiant souls who stayed up night after night, missing meals and sleep, to hear a varied assortment of wails, squeaks, and grunts over their earphones.
I remember that myself very well. Just the same, radio owes a great deal to those early listeners in to the wireless. Without them, radio wouldn't be what it is today.
Well, just for the record, Dr. Thomas, when did radio broadcasting actually begin?
That, Mr. Shannon, is what the legal profession would call a leading question. Radio broadcasting as we know it today began with the first regularly scheduled broadcast, the Harding Cox presidential election returns, on the night of November 2nd, 1920.
1920? Why, I thought it started long before that.
Many other people think the same thing, but nevertheless, that's when radio broadcasting was born. As a matter of fact, the term radio broadcasting wasn't even coined prior to that date. True, there had been many earlier wireless transmissions. Reginald A. Fessenden and Lee DeForest sent out experimental programs as far back as 1906 and 7. In 1919, Dr. Frank Conrad, one of my engineering associates, began some experimental programs from his station in the garage of his home. The November 2nd broadcast was the culmination of these programs and other experiments and research efforts, both before and after those dates.
I see. Then the November 2nd broadcast put radio, as we know it today, on a regularly scheduled program basis. Is that right?
That is correct. And KDKA has continued to broadcast on a regular schedule every day since that date.
That must have been an exciting night for all concerned. for the men who did the broadcasting and the listeners who heard it.
Yes, radio history was made that night. The dawn of a new era of communication. And few, if any, of the men who took part in that event could possibly have realized what a tremendous force was about to be loosed on humanity.
I'd like to have been there, or even had the privilege of hearing that broadcast. It must have been a real thrill.
It was, for all concerned.
Where did that first scheduled broadcast originate, Dr. Thomas? And what was it like? You were right in the middle of things around that time, weren't you?
Yes, I was. Not on the broadcasting end, of course. I was interested more in the technical side of wireless. However, suppose I set the scene for you and try to recreate the program as closely as I can from the records and from memory.
All right.
The broadcast itself emanated from a very small room atop a factory building called the K Building in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Just a crude little shack it was. The room, I mean, not the building.
Yes.
Inside this small room, bare except for the transmitter set in one corner, and incidentally, this transmitter weighed only about 500 pounds. Contrast that with KDK's present transmitting equipment, which weighs around 328,000 pounds. Next to it, running lengthwise, a long table, three chairs and a high stool. And around here was gathered a group of men. An announcer, an engineer, and a checker. And two men taking down election returns as they came in over the telephones.
You mentioned a checker. What was his job?
His job was to check the messages for clarity and correctness before they went on the air.
I see. For those early days, that sounds like a well-thought-out arrangement, Dr. Thomas. The returns came in by phone, the checker checked them, and the announcer gave them on the air. Well, come to think of it, election returns are given pretty much the same way today.
Don't look so surprised, Mr. Shannon. A great many radio patterns or formats had their beginnings in those early days of radio. That arrangement worked on November 2nd, 1920, and it still works.
What time did the election returns broadcast go on the air that Tuesday night, Dr. Thomas?
Oh, it was about 6 o'clock, and a stormy night it was, too, raining cats and dogs. But the election interest and excitement made the weather a poor second as a topic of conversation.
I can imagine.
Newspapers ran banner headlines reading,
"Greatest vote in nation's history in spite of storms. Heavy vote being cast.
Harding awaits complacently result of vote.
Governor Cox more confident than ever, he says."
Meanwhile, Dr. Conrad was standing by at his experimental station, 8XK, ready to take over in case of transmitter trouble. And up in the small room, our group of radio broadcasting pioneers completed the last-minute details for their broadcast. Finally, the time came.
"Okay. You fellas all set?
We're set, Joe.
When I throw this switch, you start talking.
Right.
I'll give you the signal. Everybody ready?
Right, sir.
Yeah, I'm up there.
Okay, it's all yours."
"This is KDKA of the Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We shall now broadcast the election returns. We are receiving these returns through the cooperation and by special arrangements with the Pittsburgh Post and Sun. The election returns will be broadcast as soon as they are received by us here at KDKA. We'd appreciate it if anyone hearing this broadcast would communicate with us, as we are very anxious to know how far the broadcast is reaching and how it is being received. Write your card or letter to station KDKA, East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And now, while we're waiting for the returns to come in over the telephone, direct from the Post and Sun, I'll give you the list of offices in today's presidential election. Here they are. Some 30 million Americans are electing a president of the United States, a vice president, 34 United States senators, 435 members of the House of Representatives, governors of 34 states, and thousands of minor offices, county judges, and officials. Okay, those are the offices to be filled. And here are the 7 complete presidential tickets that are being voted on. I guess you all know these names pretty well by this time, but there's no harm repeating them. And we have to wait for the returns anyhow. Here's the list. Republican, Warren G. Harding and Calvin Coolidge. Democratic, James M. Cox and Franklin D. Roosevelt. Socialist, Eugene V. Debs and Seymour Stedman. Prohibition, Aaron S. Watkins and Leigh Colvin. Farmer Labor, Parley S. Christensen and Max S. Hayes. Socialist Labor Party, William Cox and August Gilhas. Single Tax, R.C. McCauley and R.C. Barnum. Well, those are the candidates running for the various offices in this election. And we're going to stay right here and broadcast the returns as they come into us. So please stand by.
And so the election returns continued intermittently throughout that night.
And here's another one here. A return from Topeka, Kansas. The first 206 votes counted in four scattering precincts have Harding, 109, Cox, 96, and Debs, 1. That's Harding, 109, Cox, 96, Debs, 1.
Okay, I'll take over while you get some coffee and sandwich if you want some drink. Say, Captain?
No, nothing much yet. It's too early. So what time is it?
A little after 11.
We've got a long way to go yet. Oh, look, I just gave this bulletin from here, and I'm just going to give this one from Norwell, Massachusetts.
All right, I'll let you think about it.
Reports from the town of Norwell, Massachusetts, giving the complete vote on the presidential electors and the gubernatorial candidates are: for president, Harding and Coolidge, 409. Cox and Roosevelt, 48. And here's an item about President Wilson. After receiving the early election returns, President Wilson retired to his bedroom at 9 p.m. tonight and was asleep a half hour later. Oh, just a minute. A bulletin has just come in. I'll read it to you. The Democratic candidate, James M. Cox, and his chief manager, Chairman White, of the Democratic National Committee, have conceded the election of Senator Harding. Yes, sir, the election is conceded by Cox to Harding. And it looks like Warren G. Harding and Calvin Coolidge are the men who will carry the affairs of our nation for the next 4 years. Of course, don't forget all the returns are not in by any manner of means. So stand by and we'll give them to you as they come in. So you'll have the complete story as we broadcast.
Gosh, that must have been quite a broadcast, Dr. Thomas. Was that the end of it when Governor Cox conceded?
No, by no means. The schedule called for the election returns to be broadcast from the time the polls opened to about noon the next day. Around noon on Wednesday, November 3rd, a very tired, sleepy group of broadcasters gave the final returns. That is, as final as they could be up to that time.
Swept into the presidency with the largest popular majority in history. The greatest popular vote in the history of American politics. And the largest electoral vote ever rolled up by a Republican candidate. Harding's electoral vote had reached 391, with indications that doubtful states might carry the figure to the 400 mark. And so, here are the incomplete returns again. Harding, 391 electoral votes. Cox, 127. Now, before we leave you, I'd like to ask all those who heard this election broadcast to communicate with us, telling us how it was received. We are anxious to know how far the broadcast reached. Just write a card or letter to station KDKA, East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This is KDKA of the Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, signing off until 7 o'clock this evening.
And that was it.
That was it. The first regularly scheduled broadcast in radio history. And to the men who broadcast those election returns and to the few hundred listeners, it was more than just that. It was the dawn of a new age of communication.
It seems to me there's a great deal more to this story of radio, Dr. Thomas.
Indeed there is, Mr. Shannon, a great deal more.
Well, then suppose we make it a date for next week.
That's agreeable. See you then.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard another in the series of programs titled Adventures in Research. Your guide telling the story of the first scheduled radio broadcast in history was Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratory.
Good morning. It's the 2nd of November, 2022. My name is Arthur. That's a show I found and I haven't yet played before. I'm going to bookend yours truly, Johnny Dollar, with this Adventures in Research. There's not much I could find on it. Phillips Thomas was a physicist for the Westinghouse, and I guess he decided to dramatize some inventions throughout the years. Anyway, we'll go ahead and continue here with yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Thanks for listening. This is titled The Rasmussen Matter. This had an original air date of the 16th of December, 1956.
It's time now for... Johnny Dollar.
My name is Hardy, Mr. Dollar.
Yes?
I'm returning the call you made to Mr. Ellis Rasmussen. If you will state your business, I shall be glad to transmit it to him.
You tell Mr. Rasmussen I'm an insurance investigator from Hartford, and the matter involves a member of his own family.
Oh, young Mr. Rasmussen?
Yes.
Could you hold on a moment, sir?
I could.
Mr. Rasmussen will send a car for you at 6 o'clock.
Look, I can take a cab. Oh, well.
Bob Bailey in the exciting adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account. America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to the Universal Adjustment Bureau, Hartford, Connecticut. The following is an account of expenses incurred during my investigation of the Rasmussen matter. Expense account item one, $204.35, airfare from Hartford to San Francisco to Los Angeles, trying to compile the details of the Rasmussen case. I'd been on it 3 days when I was stonewalled in Los Angeles with a Holmby Hills address and the phone number of Ellis Rasmussen. At 6 o'clock, a liveried chauffeur in immaculate uniform stepped up to me at the desk.
Mr. Dollar?
Yes?
My name is Stauffer, sir. I have Mr. Rasmussen's car outside.
Well, gee whiz, Stauffer.
Ain't it the truth, sir?
A few minutes later, when we turned into the lush green Holmby Hills section, I had a suspicion I was about to deal with a bona fide millionaire. When we parked in front of the big two-story colonial home and a man with graying hair and swallowtail coat stepped out of the door, well, I knew I was going to meet the real article.
I'm Hardy, sir.
Hello, Hardy.
Mr. Rasmussen is waiting for you. This way, please.
We stopped in front of a huge paneled door. Hardy tapped on it once, then pulled on the knob. As we entered, a tall man with a shock of pure white hair rose from his chair and turned toward us.
This is Mr. Dollar, Mr. Rasmussen.
I want about 4 fingers of sour mash. What do you want?
You took the words right out of my mouth, Mr. Rasmussen.
Very good, sir.
He's a pretty nice fellow.
We're all pretty nice fellows around here, Mr. Dollar. Sit down.
Thanks.
Could you hand me that lighter?
Oh, sure. Here.
Thank you. What are you doing in Los Angeles?
Why, Federal Underwriters of Hartford wrote a blanket policy for all Imperial Rubber Company employees. Your son was an executive with Imperial when he was killed in Malaya last spring. Federal owes his widow $25,000.
I don't know where she is, Mr. Dollar.
I see.
I doubt if you do. Let me put it this way. I never met the young lady. Fred married her one night in Elko, Nevada. 2 days later, they were on their way to Malaya. 6 months there, and the development station was raided by guerrillas one night. And I suddenly no longer have a son. Have you eaten your dinner, Mr. Dollar?
Oh, I wouldn't want to trouble
you. Hardy, set a place for Mr. Dollar.
Very good, sir.
Well?
Well, I thought she might phone me when she got back to the States. She never did. Never a letter, nothing. I'm old and sick, but I still want to see the girl my son married. It's not an easy thing to lose a son, Mr. Dollar. And I lost a good one. I lost the best son a man ever had.
I'm sure you did, sir. To your son.
To Fred.
During dinner and afterward over coffee and liqueurs, I listened to the story of Ellis Rasmussen's life. It came from the lips of an old man who was dying, but in whose eyes I could see reflected the memories of a brawling, bustling life that started in an Oklahoma oil field and moved to Alaska and Arabia and Africa. More and more during the talk, I began to know his lost son. For in everything the old man had to say about himself, I could sense an unmistakable reflection of his son. Finally, I thanked him and left.
If I may say so, I do hope you'll call soon again, sir. Mr. Rasmussen enjoyed your visit very much. I haven't seen him so much like his old self since we received the terrible news of young Mr. Rasmussen's death.
He must have been quite a man, Hardy, young Fred Rasmussen.
Yeah, he was, sir. All of us miss him dreadfully. None of us ever met Mrs. Rasmussen, and we were most anxious to receive her, especially after young Mr. Fred's death.
I imagine so.
The car's all ready, Mr. Dollar.
Good night, sir.
Good night, Hardy.
Fine night, Mr. Dollar.
Yeah. Stomper.
Yes, sir?
I didn't want to press the point with Mr. Rasmussen, but now maybe you can straighten me out. Did he approve of his son's marriage?
Let's put it this way, Mr. Dollar. Mr. Rasmussen approved of Mr. Fred. And if Mr. Fred got himself married, then Mr. Rasmussen approved of the girl. Between them two, they had that kind of understanding. Real people.
Expense account item 2, $1.98, telegram to Personnel Division Imperial Rubber Company requesting a copy of all information they might have on Laura Olson Rasmussen. Item 3, $6, one long-distance phone call to the Universal agent working the case in San Francisco.
Mrs. Rasmussen left the Malaya Peninsula by boat from a town called Coschetti 3 days after the news of her husband's death. A week later, she booked plane passage in Hong Kong with Trans-Pacific Airlines. She changed planes in Honolulu. She cleared the Port Authority in San Francisco. From there on, we lost her.
Get a list of all the passengers who were on that plane.
Okay.
Get someone checking the hotels in the Bay Area. She might have checked into one when she hit Frisco.
Okay.
Now listen, we're looking for a woman whose husband was brutally murdered about 2 weeks before she got back to the States. If she's anything like I think, she was probably about at the end of a rope. Now start asking questions at places where people like that go.
Right.
On Wednesday morning, I rented a car. That's item 4, $25, and made the rounds. First stop, Los Angeles Board of Education. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I had found 35 Laura Olsons who had attended public school in Los Angeles and were more or less in the proper age bracket. The next day, the folder arrived from Imperial Rubber Company. Among other things, it contained a passport picture and a complete description of Laura Olson Rasmussen. She was a blonde girl with a pouting, sultry kind of mouth and wide, dark eyes.
You down there.
Yes?
What do you want?
I'm looking for Mrs. Frances Olson. Are you Mrs. Olson?
I don't want to buy nothing.
Do you have a daughter named Laura Olson?
Are you a policeman?
No, I'm an insurance investigator. I'm trying to locate Laura Olson Rasmussen.
Well, how'd you get this address? What's that?
A picture of her.
I see. That's my Laura. What about her?
I've been trying to locate her for some time. Is she here?
No, she ain't here. She ain't been here for 5 years.
Do you have any idea where I can find her? Friends, maybe? Other relatives?
You say her name's Rasmussen now?
Yes, she married a man named Fred Rasmussen.
Married? Well, ain't that just something?
You didn't know your daughter had been married, Mrs. Olson?
How would I know? How would I know anything about her?
Saturday at noon, a registered letter arrived from the agent in San Francisco containing the list of passengers who had been on the plane with her. Three of the names were in the Los Angeles area, including a Mr. Oberlin who lived in Pasadena.
For sure, I remember her. Real pretty. We sat together all the way from Honolulu. What's up?
We're trying to locate her, Mr. Oberlin. Did she happen to mention her plans when she returned to the States?
Plans?
You know, what hotel she might be staying at in San Francisco? Or if she was going on to another city?
Uh-uh. No, not her.
You say that very emphatically.
Yeah, I guess I do. You didn't have to show me a picture. You know, a guy always prays he'll meet someone like her on a plane, you know what I mean? Yeah, live it up. Yesterday's gone, she said tomorrow ain't here, and the only thing we got is today. Yeah, we had a swell time.
You're sure about this?
We were pretty chummy, pal, if you want the truth of it.
Mr. Roebelin, did she mention anything about being in Malaya before she boarded that plane?
Uh-uh.
Then she didn't tell you that her husband had been killed a week before.
Killed? How?
He was murdered by guerrillas in Malaya.
No, she didn't mention that. She didn't mention that at all, Mr. Dollar.
Johnny Dollar.
This is Hardy, Mr. Dollar.
How are you, Hardy? How's Mr. Rasmussen?
He's not so well, sir. That's why I called. Could you possibly find time to visit him?
Tonight?
May I send a car right away?
Is it serious?
He's dying, sir.
I knew why he wanted to see me. Have you located my daughter-in-law yet? No, I haven't located her, Mr. Rasmussen. But I know something about her. I know she drank whiskey and flirted with a fat salesman on an airplane all the way from Honolulu to San Francisco. I know her mother's a drunk. I know she didn't think enough of you or your son to contact you or anybody else when she got back. Mr. Rasmussen, it looks to me like your daughter-in-law is a first-class bum.
Act two of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, in just a moment.
Sorry, that was a little blunt. Yes, no, you're listening to... My name is Arthur, and you're listening to The Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. I'm going to continue here with the Rasmussen matter with an original air date of the 16th of December, 1956. Thanks for listening.
There was a black coupe with MD on the license parked in the driveway of the Rasmussen house when we pulled up. In the bedroom, a silvery-haired man in a black suit was sitting beside the bed that held Ellis Rasmussen. He was introduced as Dr. Butler. Then I shook the hand of Mr. Rasmussen. Someone suggested that Dr. Butler might like to use the library for his calls. And I was alone with the old man.
If you want some whiskey, I keep it in the sideboard over there.
Not now, thanks. I wish I had some news for you, Mr. Rasmussen. We're finding out things, but we haven't found her yet.
What things?
Oh, things. Nothing important.
Dollar, if I judge you right, you know your business. And if you haven't found my daughter-in-law by now, you've certainly found out what kind of person she is. So tell me.
I haven't met her. I don't know.
You're being evasive.
I don't work for you, Mr. Rasmussen. I'm an insurance investigator trying to locate a woman and pay off a claim. If I don't find her, the case will just have to sit. Unless you or someone else concerned makes a report to missing persons. Then the cops can take over, and maybe they should right now.
My son was a fine man. I can look back on all the years I had with him and be proud of every year and every day. He married a girl named Laura Olson. I don't know where she came from or who she was, but I know my son wouldn't have married her unless he loved her, unless she loved him in return and was worthy of his love.
You know a lot, Mr. Rasmussen.
Perhaps I should go to the police.
No. No, don't do that. We'll find her, Mr. Rasmussen. We're getting it narrowed down. Well, I'd better leave now.
As you say. But Mr. Dollar.
Yes, sir.
I want to see her.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry I talked to you the way I did.
Phone call for you, Mr. Dollar. Would you like to take it in there?
Oh, yeah, sure. Keep an eye on him, Hardy.
Trust me, sir.
Johnny Dollar.
This is Officer Daly, Los Angeles Police.
Oh, yeah.
You the insurance guy looking for a Laura Olson Rasmussen?
Yeah, have you got anything?
We got her.
Huh?
She's here with the rest of the girls in the drunk tank.
A drunk tank will always smell of disinfectant. This one was no different. There are no bunks, no chairs, no blankets, no nothing. So you stand or sit on a concrete floor and wait for something to happen. The legal period is 24 hours. You get rebooked or you get released. It all depends.
What's the story on her, Dollar?
I've got a check for $25,000 for her.
Gee, insurance money?
Yeah.
Quiet! Quiet in there! All right, quiet down! You girls better learn to get along.
Which one?
Back there, sitting on the floor.
Oh, what's the situation?
If somebody comes up with bail, they can have her.
Expense account item 7, $100, bail. While I was waiting around, Officer Daly broke open a file on her. A dozen aliases, a dozen charges, and one conviction for shoplifting. A career of petty thievery that began at the age of 16 and ran up into a 22nd year. Expense account item A, $35, telegrams. I sent wires to all parties concerned, all parties except Ellis Rasmussen, ordering a stop on their activities since Laura Olson Rasmussen had been found.
Over there.
Who are you?
My name's Johnny Dollar.
Thanks for getting me out. Why?
I did it for a friend.
Friend? I didn't know I had any.
Expense account item 9, 20 cents, 2 cups of coffee. We had it in a diner across from the women's section of the main jail. I looked at Laura Olson Rasmussen while she drank the coffee. Looked at the blonde hair and the wide eyes and the pouting mouth. Looked at the woman who had once been the wife of Fred Rasmussen.
What's the catch, mister?
No catch.
You put up $100 for me. I don't know you from a load of coal.
No, you don't. Where do you live?
I've been staying at the Piedmont Hotel. You know where it is?
No.
No, not many people do. Especially people with clean shirts.
What have you been doing since you got back from Malaya?
I've been getting along. You got something to do with Fred? You know about Malaya.
I know about a lot of things. I've been looking for you for a month.
So what?
Why didn't you contact your father-in-law when you got back?
Why should I? What would he care about me? He never met me. What do I mean to him?
Right now, since he no longer has a son, you mean everything to him.
You're kidding me, mister.
I wish I was kidding you. I wish to heaven I was kidding you.
Well, what now?
Oh, I want you to come over to my hotel with
me. Oh, now, look.
To sign it... some papers. I have a check for $25,000 for you.
What was that?
Your husband was insured. You're his beneficiary. All you have to do is fill out an application. I'll give you the check.
I don't believe it.
It's true. Come on. Expense account item 10, $2, cab fare to my hotel. I took her upstairs with me, stood over her while she filled out the necessary papers. Outside of that, we didn't say a word. Johnny Dollar.
This is Stauffer, Mr. Dollar. Hardy asked me to phone you to see if there's any word.
Oh, yes.
Well, what'll I tell him, Mr. Dollar?
Tell him no luck yet, Stauffer. How's the old man?
About the same, sir. Counting on you, I think.
I'll talk to you later.
Yes, sir.
Here you are.
Okay. Thanks. Here's your check.
Anything else?
Nope. That's it.
Okay. See you around sometime.
Sure.
Fred told me about a man named Stoffer who worked for his old man for years. Was that him on the phone just now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was going to say to the old man, but I did know I was hoping that if Rasmussen had to die, that he'd die before anybody told him the kind of daughter-in-law I'd turned up. I didn't want to be in on that. Expense account item 11, $83, hotel bill. I checked out at 5:30, picked up my airline tickets at the desk, that's item 12, then sat around the lobby for 5 minutes. Item 13, two drinks for myself.
Mr. Dollar?
Yeah? Oh.
I read in the paper that Ellis Rasmussen is dying. Is that true?
That's true.
Mind if I sit down?
Suit yourself. What are you drinking?
Nothing. I know why you didn't tell them you found me, and I don't blame you. If Fred's dad is anything like Fred was, then I know how you felt, finding me the way you did.
Let's forget it, Mrs. Rasmussen, shall we?
I'd like to meet Fred's father.
So you want to meet him, huh? The human thing would have been to see him when you came back. But not a line, not a word. That old man in that house knows his son was really a man. And on that basis, he believes, without seeing you, that his son married a real woman. He had love and sympathy and help and devotion and all the things you don't seem to have any use for waiting for you in that house. He... Oh, never mind.
I loved Fred. Loved him from the first minute I saw him. You know what I was doing when I saw him? I was serving cocktails in a place like this. He didn't ask me what kind of a family I came from, whether I was good or bad. He just put one of those big arms around me one night and said, "You're mine." He said that to me. He said it because he loved me. No one ever loved me. No one. But he did. I told him who I was and where I came from, and all he said was, "You're with me now." We went to Malaya together, and I never knew in all of my life what I knew then, how it was to be wanted by someone who was decent, kind. And then he was killed. He told me one afternoon when I was in Cachetti. I took a boat, and then I took a plane back here.
Go on.
I want to see Fred's father. I took a car to the house, and I saw what kind of a house and what kind of people his family were. I didn't go in. Couldn't you see me, cheap, rotten, dirty little me? Couldn't you see me walking in there and saying, "I'm me"? Couldn't you see that mother of mine moving in? What would that have done to the old man? It would have crushed out his whole memory of Fred. But don't think, Mr. Dollar, I haven't got my memory, too. I didn't drink that away. I was loved by a man. And I loved him back. I've still got that.
I'm going out there pretty soon. Would you like to meet him?
Do you think I can?
I think so. I think so very much.
Oh, Mr. Dollar, I've been waiting in the lobby. I thought you might be here. How do you do, miss?
Stoffer,
I'd like you to meet Mrs. Rasmussen.
Well, my, my. I'm mighty pleased to meet you. The boss will be mighty happy.
She dried her eyes in the car. I didn't say much. She didn't say much. But in the half hour it took to get out to Holmby Hills, something happened to her again. The something that must have happened when the big arm went around her shoulders the first time.
Good evening.
Mrs. Rasmussen, Hardy.
How do you do, Mrs. Rasmussen? We're very happy to see you.
Thank you, Hardy. Fred spoke of you often.
That was kind of Fred. This way, please.
Come in, come in.
I think you can introduce Mrs. Rasmussen, Mr. Dollar. Ring if you need me, sir.
I'm scared.
Laura, if there ever was a man for you not to be scared of, it's that man in there.
How can I tell him about myself? I've been in jail. I can't...
Watch.
Well, Mr. Dollar, come in. I've
brought someone for you to meet, Mr. Rasmussen.
Come here. You'd be my son's Laura. Yes, you're Laura.
Hello.
Yes. Oh, now, there, here, here. Now, look, us Rasmussens mustn't meet like this with tears.
There's so much I have to tell you.
No, there's nothing you have to tell me.
What?
Let me put my arm around you. There. Now, feel it. Mm-hmm. You're my daughter. Do you understand that?
Oh, yes.
Then that's all the explanations we need between us. Yes. Hardy. Hardy.
Yes, Mr. Rasmussen?
Bring Mrs. Rasmussen some brandy, I think. And I'll have some sour mash, Mr. Dollar.
Sure. Make mine sour mash, too, Hardy.
Very good, sir.
Expense account item 14, $40. Miscellaneous. Item 15, $35. Stenographic. Expense account total $1,965. Remarks? The old man's got a few weeks more. Laura's moving into the house with him to take care of him. She won't be telling him a lot of things about herself. She doesn't have to. You should have stood there like I did and seen that big arm go around her shoulder when he said, "You're my daughter." Yeah. Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
This is your captain. We are going to be experiencing some slight turbulence. Please fasten your... Oh, hold on. Just got a video of my cat.
Imagine the pilot of an airplane was as confident as you are texting and driving. Seems kind of crazy when you put it like that.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Okay, thank you, Ad Council. That was yours truly, Johnny Dollar, the Rasmussen Matter, with an original air date of the 16th of December, 1956. I'm playing out my concluding music now because I'm just going to run out this reckless adventures in research. Again, it's going to be the eyes and ears for millions, but this is part two. This was aired on the 28th of November, 1944. The one we heard at the top of the hour was aired on a week earlier on the 21st of November, 1944. My name is Arthur, and this has been the Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. Thanks for listening.
Adventures in Research. How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? And welcome to another in the series of weekly programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. And here, ready to take us adventuring, is Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Paul, and hello, everyone.
Well, Dr. Thomas, this is the day you promised to tell us more about the story of Eyes and Ears for the Millions, the story of telegraph, telephone, radio, and television.
That's right, Mr. Shannon. We've already told the story of the first regularly scheduled broadcast of November 2nd, 1920, over the newborn radio station, KDKA, nursed into being by Dr. Frank Conrad, and thus turning what had been a dream into a reality, harnessing the swift, invisible energy, electricity, for communication.
Yes, and where do we go from there, Dr. Thomas?
Well, behind the triumph of that day lay a century of brilliant achievement. Men had always dreamed of using electricity to span space with words and messages, even before they knew what an electric cell or generator looked like.
That old urge, curiosity.
Yes, but curiosity with a definite purpose and goal. It was late in October of 1832 when Samuel F.B. Morse, a well-known painter, returned to America after a few years of study abroad. On the home voyage, Morse had caught the bug. After talking with a learned professor on the newly discovered wonders of electricity.
Yes, there are a great many things, amazing, wonderful things, that will come out of this new discovery. I could wish that I were 20, no, 30 years younger, so that I might help in the development of this wonder, electricity.
The story you have told of this new power kindles the imagination, sir. Why, there are no limits to the possibilities.
I can almost see the wheels of your eager imagination turning in your head, Mr. Morse. Of what are you thinking?
I was just thinking, this new strange power might be used, as you said, for many things like sending messages. Well, thank you, Professor. And now, if you'll excuse me, I must put some thoughts on paper before I forget.
Ah, youth and imagination. Who can stop them in their progress? My word, time for lunch.
Samuel Morse had plans for his telegraph when he left the ship. But 12 years of hard work, experimentation, and disappointment were to follow before he could perfect his device and prove it to a doubting world.
12 years is a long time to devote to one thing, and just an idea on paper at that.
Yes, it is, but a very brief period of time as compared to the countless men of science and others who have devoted a whole lifetime to one idea or cause and never lived to see the final results of their work.
Yes, I see what you mean, Dr. Thomas. They supply the idea in the first place, work on it without too much success, and others come along and put the finishing touch to it, and there it is.
Exactly. Ours is an impatient world which is not too much concerned with names and personalities, but which wishes only to see the results of their labors. This it is thus it has ever been with pioneers. Well, to get back to our story, it was on May 24, 1844, that Samuel Morse sat in the Supreme Courtroom of the nation's capital, surrounded by the statesman who had finally been persuaded to help him. In Baltimore, at the other end of the first real telegraph line, was Alfred Vail, the young man who had worked for years with Morse to help him develop his instrument.
The chair recognizes Samuel Morse.
Gentlemen, there is little I wish to say at this time. I propose to let this instrument I have brought with me speak for me. My assistant, Alfred Vail, is at this moment seated before another instrument, similar to the one I have here in Baltimore, Maryland. I shall send him a message by telegraph, which he will repeat as soon as he receives it. Now, gentlemen, I ask that there be absolute silence during this experiment, please. Thank you.
Yes, as the astonished statesmen listened, their doubts vanishing, the message sent by Samuel Morse in Washington to Alfred Vail in Baltimore was repeated, word for word. What hath God wrought? The first great long-distance message sent by electricity.
That must have been a mighty proud day for those two, Dr. Thomas, and for everyone connected with that first telegraph.
Yes, and an exciting day for history, too, Mr. Shannon.
I can imagine. What was Morse's invention like?
It was based on a principle almost every schoolboy knows today, the principle of electromagnetism.
Mm-hmm.
When an electric current flows through a wire, it creates a magnetic field around the wire.
Yes.
If the wire is wound around a soft iron bar, the magnetic field about the wire is concentrated in the iron, making the iron a strong magnet as long as the current continues to flow.
I see. Well, what happens when the current stops flowing?
As soon as the current stops, the iron loses its magnetism. Such a magnet is called an electromagnet.
Well, what kind of a telegraph key did Morse use, Dr. Thomas?
His key was nothing more than a switch which opened and closed an electric circuit at the touch of a finger. At the receiving end, this current ran through the coils of an electromagnet, whose force could be used in a number of ways, so that the pinpoint made a mark on a moving tape, or it could be recorded on the moving tape, or it could attract a bar of metal which clicked down when current flowed through the electromagnet and sprang back when the current stopped.
Must have taken a lot of brains and engineering ability to figure that out, I'd say.
Indeed, yes.
Well, what about the code they used, Dr. Thomas?
The code was one that was worked out by Morse and Vail. A code representing letters and numbers by dots and dashes. So that it was a simple matter for a person receiving the message to interpret the clicks, or the long and short lines on the moving tape. Morse's code is still in use today in modern telegraphy.
Yes, I remember learning the Morse code when I was a Boy Scout. At home, my brother and I used to practice tapping out messages to each other on the tables, the chairs, and anything else that would make a noise, especially at mealtimes.
That was probably as easy a way as any to say, pass the butter, without saying please.
Yes, it was.
Well, getting along with our story here. About 20 years or so after Morse and Vail sent their epoch-making message, a British physicist and mathematician published an essay that caused some excitement in high scientific circles.
I say, this is the most extraordinary thing I ever heard. Just listen to this. I am convinced that there must exist electric impulses just like light waves, but of a different length. And then he goes on to say, there are probably other waves longer than light waves which cannot be detected by the eyes. In every other respect, the waves are exactly the same as light waves. That's extraordinary. A very nice theory, of course, but after all, it's only on paper.
What does all that mean, Dr. Thomas?
Well, this British physicist was James Clerk Maxwell, who had done a little mathematical figuring. Mm-hmm. It seemed to him, as his essay read, that there must exist electric impulses just like light waves, but of different lengths.
Yes.
Now, light waves, as we know them today, are electromagnetic radiations, which travel through space at the rate of 186,000 miles a second. The waves are very short, ranging in length from the tiny violet light waves, about 16 millionths of 1 inch long, to the somewhat longer waves of red light, 26 millionths long.
Gosh, I can't even imagine anything that short. Well, Dr. Thomas, what did that remark mean? A very nice theory, of course, but only on paper.
Well, you see, there seemed to be no way of proving it except by intricate mathematical calculations.
And was it proved?
Well, patience, Mr. Shannon. We have to move along now to the year 1887, when a youthful physics professor at a high school in Karlsruhe, in Germany, Heinrich Rudolf Hertz, told the world of some amazing experiments that he had been performing for the past 2 years. Experiments that showed beyond a shadow of a doubt that James Clerk Maxwell's figuring was correct.
Good. Then it was proved after all, even though it was much later. Heinrich Rudolf Hertz. That name is very familiar to me, Dr. Thomas.
It should be, Mr. Shannon. Hertz is called by many the father of radio. In fact, radio waves are often referred to as Hertzian waves.
Oh, sure. That's right. Well, what kind of experiments was he performing?
Well, briefly, he discovered that when he made a spark leap across a gap in an electrical circuit, he produced electromagnetic waves like the ones Maxwell had predicted.
How did he discover them?
to detect the waves, Hertz used a small hoop of wire which held two balls of metal a short distance apart.
Yes?
The waves from the spark made another electric spark jump almost instantaneously between these two metal balls, mm-hmm. you see? Mm-hmm. With this simple apparatus, Hertz was able to prove everything that Maxwell said. He showed that the waves traveled through space with the same speed as light, mm-hmm. and that they could be reflected or bent, just like light. But more than that, he opened the door to the possibility of sending messages electrically, without wire.
Hmm. And in a way, it proves what you were saying, Dr. Thomas, about one man devoting his life to an idea or a theory, and another man finishing it.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
Well, what happened after Hertz made his experiment announcement?
A great many things. By 1895, many great men were hot in pursuit of capturing these waves that Hertz had described. One in particular was not very widely known, for he was only a young man of about 21, the son of a wealthy Italian banker.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1895, this young man, Guglielmo Marconi, was launching an experiment which was destined to grow into an enormous contribution to the world.
Marconi, wireless telegraphy.
Yes, the two are synonymous today. But back in 1895, they were not so well known, Mr. Shannon. And very few persons even knew about Marconi's experiments at that time.
What kind of experiments were they, Dr. Thomas?
Well, in his father's garden, outside the city of Bologna, young Marconi had rigged up a spark gap similar to the one Heinrich Hertz had used in his experiments.
Mm-hmm.
But leading from this gap were two wires, one buried in the ground and the other carried high aloft in the air.
Yes.
Marconi was experimenting with antennas, and proving to himself that with the proper antenna, a message could be sent over long distances.
Hmm.
That same year, 1895, he succeeded in sending a message to his father a mile away.
That was progress, all right.
Yes, but he wasn't satisfied. He dreamed of sending a message across the ocean.
That sounds just like a scientist. To get something to the point where it will work, then tear it down and build it up again so it works even better than it was at first hoped for. Never satisfied.
Isn't it, though? Just the same, that's what makes for progress, Mr. Shannon, particularly in this electrical age of ours. A device has to be as near perfect as is humanly possible before it can be marketed.
Yes, I get your point, Dr. Thomas. Well, what happened next to Marconi and his experiments?
From his father's garden in Italy, Marconi moved to England for further experimentation. Bit by bit, he lengthened the stride of his messages, until finally, in December of 1901, he was ready for the great test.
You mean the sending of a message across the ocean, as he'd dreamed?
That's right. In Purldew, England, Marconi had set up a powerful sending station with receiving equipment in an old watchtower overlooking the harbor of St. John's, Newfoundland. On December 12th, all was in readiness to forge another vital link in the chain of communication.
And an exciting link it was, too, I imagine, Dr. Thomas. Gosh, I've been so interested in your story that I hadn't noticed how the time was flying. Can we tell the story of that experiment next week?
We certainly can, Mr. Shannon. You'll find it a most interesting one, I promise you.
All right, and thank you, Dr. Thomas. That's a date for next week, then. Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard another in the series of programs titled Adventures in Research. Your guide along these adventurous highways and byways of science, telling the story of our various communications and their history, under the title Eyes and Ears for the Millions.
Where it is that you come from.